Hi, I'm Skating PJ, and this is Let's Talk About It, the Skate Ontario podcast, where we're going to get up close and personal with members of our skating family who have a connection to Ontario. So, let's talk about it. Hi, everybody. At Skating PJ here with another great episode of the Let's Talk About It podcast. I am thrilled to welcome today my very good friend, Olympic coach, broadcaster, all-around nice guy. This is Carol Lane. Carol, thank you for joining me.
Hi, PJ. Hi, everybody.
This is just wonderful to have you here. So this is, of course, our Olympic season. Yes. Skate Ontario is very excited because it looks as if we will probably have skaters going to the Olympic Games. And you've been at every Olympic Games in one capacity or another since 2010.
Yes.
That's very exciting.
I've got the gray hair and scars to prove it, too.
Yes. I bet. So let's talk about, first of all, what I'd like to know is how you feel about the Olympic Games. I mean, you come at it from a position of having been an elite figure skater for Team GB way back in the day. Right. And this was at a time before ice dance was part of the Olympic program. So what does it mean to you to see ice dance at the Olympics?
I think it's marvelous. I mean, ice dance has so many wonderful things to offer, not just a skating audience, but a regular viewing audience. You know, you can, there's so many things to enjoy. The skating, first of all, and how accomplished all of the skaters are now in every discipline. I mean, it's not the same sport that I did, actually. It's completely different now to how it used to be. Same elements of things, but, you know, just the development of the athleticism, I think, along with the increased awareness of movement and intention, and dance generally, I think, has weaved its way into all of the disciplines in skating to create something that literally anybody that doesn't know anything about skating can sit back and enjoy a performance and get something out of it.
So way back in the day when you were training, did you do very much off ice? Because I know off ice in your program, Ice Dance Elite at Scarborough Figure Skating Club, that is a very huge component of what the ice dancers are working on. What about for you then?
No, not really. it really didn't exist. It's certainly not in the way it does now. I think we were all dabbling. We were putting our toe in the water in off ice, certainly in the last, I want to say, 3 years of my career. I had always been interested in off ice dance, so I had taken some dance classes. We did some ballroom dances. I actually had a boyfriend at the time who was a hockey player. Played for the Streatham Redskins, yes. And he was, you know, massively into fitness because of hockey. So I sort of started tagging along with him and going to the gym, which I'd never done. And it was actually really good. And I learned a lot. And I would say probably my last year of skating, which was 79, I was fit. I was very fit. The fittest I'd ever been. But that's not saying much compared to what they do now. But I think what we did do, and actually my husband John and I've had this discussion many times, is we did a lot of on ice conditioning. We had to do so many pattern dances and so many sequences. There was more, the programs were longer. And so we did a lot of sort of multiple run-throughs of programs and things like that. So our conditioning training, if you like fitness training, was much more along those lines. But we didn't, you know, going to a gym, going to ballet, going to ballroom, that was all very new in those days. But I think what we were already seeing was that the Russians were already doing all of that. You know, as they started to come to prominence with Pakhomova and Gorshkov in 76 in the first Olympics, you could see that they were doing things that we were not doing. So I think, you know, sort of going from Torvald and Dean and that generation, they were the ones who really started to embrace off-ice fitness, off-ice dance, ballet, all the things that now sort of come as standard. They're not the upgrades.
You know, it's so interesting. You know, when we talk about ballet, I know that back when I was a skater, if a skater was very much into ballet, they had to choose because the thought was you couldn't do both because it's somehow the muscles were conflicted, some kind of thing like that. You had to choose. It didn't matter what you did, what else you did in your life. If you were going to skate, then that's what you did. But I guess I'm curious about kind of the dance, I'll call it vocabulary. Mm-hmm. How do you learn a tango vocabulary, a waltz vocabulary without learning ballroom? How did you do that?
Well, I think particularly in England, we grew up very differently in our young years in ice dancing. We grew up, you know, with public sessions, with three dance intervals on every session, and everybody wanted to do them. So, and the coaches were out there skating, and you could skate with them. You know, you got your little book of dance tickets, and you away you went. But we grew up being partnered by already extremely accomplished ice dancers.
Yes.
And we learned, I have to say, I learned a lot of things through osmosis, just skating with them. And then we all skated together. You know, I was never taught any of the dances except the preliminary foxtrot and the quick step.
Wow.
I taught myself everything else, including the men's steps, because I wanted to skate with a partner. And so we all did that. We all skated together. But we grew up just kind of dancing, 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 which really doesn't happen now. It doesn't. So when you're trying to teach a pre-novice dancer a tango, it's much more difficult because they haven't done that. They're literally standing there looking at you and not really understanding at all what you want them to do. And I mean, I'm older now, so I really don't skate. In my younger days, I skated with all my younger ones and they came up the same way. Mm-hmm. Now I'm not, you know, not prepared to stuff myself into my tutu and get out there and do my thing. And it's not safe anyway anymore for me. So, but I think that has to a large extent disappeared. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we're very lucky with all of our off-ice people that work with our kids, that they understand what they're trying to teach them is how to involve that in their skating. Mm-hmm. We're not trying to make them competitive ballroom dancers or ballerinas or commercial dancers. They're trying to assist in the development of understanding dance movement and partnering, which is a whole other skill, and one that I kind of feel is gradually getting lost now. Okay. that we don't really do pattern dances above the junior level. And so it's become in a way much freer, but I also feel it's moved us away from perhaps the purity of what ice dance used to be. But that goes sort of back to my original remark that ice dance is not the same thing anymore. None of the disciplines are the same thing.
No. No, that's for sure. And it's an interesting thing about ice dance not being exactly the same thing. But I'm a big believer in framework. So, you know, if for me, and it's showing my age, and that's fine, I believe that the set pattern dances showed a framework. And I also think that at the lower levels, you could evaluate skaters, whether they were, you know, little dance teams or just solo ice dancers, you could evaluate them by comparing one to the other because apples are apples are apples.
Yes.
And I think that when you lose that framework, you also lose the thread of the story of dance. And, you know, we're going to talk about broadcast for a little bit because I know that when I'm, you know, at venues, frequently people are talking to me or in touch with me to talk about how much they love ice dance, that's the discipline they're waiting for at the Olympic Games. And I think it's because of that framework. Yeah. So what does that do to you as a coach? And then we're going to talk as a broadcaster.
Well, I'm still a big believer in involving that as much as possible.
Okay.
I think in the end, it's all about balance. It's all about the balance of, we're trying now to achieve so many things. I mean, number one, we're trying to get points, which, and points for very specific things. And so those things have now become huge. You know, the footwork, the lifts, the spins, the twizzles, the one-foot section, even the choreo movements. Just by definition, and because of what we're being asked to do with them to get points, are taking up more and more and more space in the program, which leaves you less time to do interesting things in between and perhaps show some of the dancing framework that you and I both like to see. And it's pretty much true that most of the elements require a great deal of speed in order to get the points for them. So there are only so many ways you can do that. You know, they talk about getting speed from transitions. Well, yes, all right, okay. Yeah, you to a certain extent, you can do that. But you and I both know that how do speed skaters get speed? They don't go and hold and try to do twiddly things. They lean forward and go as fast as humanly possible, pushing as hard as they can, doing basically straight strokes and cross cuts. So you're trying, I think every coach and choreographer is trying to remain true to their vision of what they feel the story of that particular program is going to be. But at the same time, you it's like having the scales sitting there. What's going to get you in the end more bang for your buck? You know, having an interesting transition filled with holds and partnering and framework and musicality, or five cross cuts going into a really amazing choreographic lift. I'm not saying either one is right or wrong. I'm just saying it's kind of like a menu now. And you have to find ways to eat off that menu and feel like you had a good meal at the end of it.
Right. So interesting that you would put it that way. And I think sometimes with the more skilled dancers, Piper and Paul among them, sometimes if you don't sort of say in red underline, look at this, look at this, look at this, the intricacy and the difficulty of what they're doing may not translate certainly to the casual fan as being something extraordinarily difficult.
No.
So when you're looking at dance teams, you know, through the lens of the monitor that you sometimes are even looking at it on the ice, how do you feel about those, you know, highlighted moments that say, look at this, it's going to be something big, or versus the sort of more nuanced performance? Are you able to sort of show that to the audience and sort of explain it?
I find commentary, particularly for ice dance, very difficult in terms of, and you know this yourself, you know, one of the things you do not want to do is talk too much through a performance and destroy the mood. I think any performance with music, talking is not what you want to do. So I think the streaming people are actually really lucky because they get way more time than you know, a regular broadcast to not talk through the performance and then at the end be able to go back and talk about all those things. In our TV commentary, we have a lot more things to deal with. There's commercials and there's other sports being flashed on and all sorts of things going on, a backstage interview, a this, a that, a something else. So we have to pick and choose very carefully what we decide to talk about. And I also think there's a massive difference between being in the rink and seeing it live and seeing it on a TV screen or a computer monitor. And I read this comment quite a lot from competitions that I've been at. Oh, so-and-so was really slow. No, they weren't. They actually were. I'm not talking about Piper and Paul. This is
in general. Yep.
You know, oh, they were so. No, they weren't. But you do lose, and the teams that make going, having that acceleration from being slow to fast and back again and providing the contrast and texture, the teams that are able to do that, I think that's really hard to see on a screen. Plus the camera is going in and coming out or maybe going over their heads. So you're not seeing the performance. So I feel on TV, we're actually talking way more about what's shown and the angle that it's shown at, which is not the same thing. I think when you're in the rink and you see the whole thing, you might come home and watch my commentary and go, well, she was talking complete rubbish. It didn't look like that at all. you can be right. But I encourage everybody that I can to go and see these skaters skate live in any way you can, you know, because it is so different watching the speed, how fast they move, where they go, how they fill the rink. You don't get that as much on a computer. But I do try to give as much, I would say my goal is to try to give as much interesting information as I can without impacting too much on the performance.
You know, it's so interesting when I talk to people who've never been to the rink to watch a live figure skating competition, and then they see the men jump. You know, some of those big jumpers, women too, very, very powerful, but there's something about, you know, as somebody's going sailing over the boards that they're like, holy smokes. Same with the pair skaters. They had no idea in an overhead lift. And when I think about being, you know, young and being an ice dance fan and an aspiring ice dancer, you know, the lifts back in the day, they couldn't go above the shoulder, you know, so they were very restricted to sort of this. So there wasn't that same drama that I think we're feeling now. You brought up a word that I want to talk about, and that is music. So as you're getting ready for, you know, the Olympic season, I'm not talking about you specifically, Carol, but coaches in general, skaters in general, there's kind of a new wrinkle, we'll put it, as the to do with selection of music. Can you talk me through that a little bit?
Well, PJ, it's the whole music licensing issue, which has been around for a long time, actually. But generally, what has happened is that, you know, as a skater, you will purchase the music that you want to use through legitimate means. And then either you or your coach or your music editor, a combination of all that, will work together to put different pieces of music together to create your program. And then generally, you know, if you're in Canada, any performance is covered by SOCAN. I forget what that acronym means. Do you remember? But anyway, it basically means whoever's running that particular event have a license for everybody to use music.
And for the music to be heard.
For the music to be heard, yes. Yeah. So, and that's how it's always been. But then there have been a few instances over the last few years of artists coming forward and saying, well, you know, you didn't get the music rights, you haven't done this properly, and now we want to charge you a lot of money.
And it's to do with streaming too, Carol, right? That's where it really came in.
That's
streaming, because streaming is global. Yeah. Because at large competitions like the World Figure Skating Championships or the Olympic Games, it was television. There was no stream involved. So it was like a one-stop shop where that was concerned. But when streaming came in, that's the real wrinkle.
That's the real kicker, yes. And so there's been lots of information and lots of disinformation this year. And we've always purchased our music, you know, from the best sources. We've always paid for that, so that was never an issue. But Skate Canada have decided that they are helping the you know, potential Olympic team with this issue this year, to navigate these waters so that we don't get into a situation where at the day before you're skating your short at the Olympics, the artist turns around and says, well, unless you give me $150,000, you can't skate tomorrow, you know.
Right.
And it happened this year, you know, that somebody had skated to something and was contacted by the artist and, you know, asked to pay. And they stopped using the music immediately. But they ended up still having to pay because they'd already used that music and it had been streamed. And we're not talking small amounts of money. We're talking big amounts of money. So, and, you know, most skaters do not make a lot of money. Some skaters make no money at all. So it can become a very big deal if somebody suddenly says to you, well, you know, pay me $40,000 or you can't go to Worlds. That's not a small piece of the pie. It's a large one. And so everybody's doing, I think, everything they can this year in Canada. I can't speak for other countries, but in Canada, we've been advised to use something called Click and Clear, and you purchase your music from Click and Clear, and there are various rights, and it tells you which countries you can use that music in. So for my skaters, anybody that's potentially going to be skating outside of Canada has gone through that process and purchased their music through Click and Clear. And so at least they have a piece of paper in their hand that says, we have tried to do this in the manner that we've been advised. And they have a piece of paper in their hand that says so. So I don't know where that's going to go, and it remains to be seen. But I do think that the more this becomes a thing and the more artists start to realize this, it can potentially get bigger and bigger.
You know what's so interesting, and I want to make sure that I say this out loud, is I know you, I mean, we've been friends for a very long time, and I know that for you, the integrity of that creative process is very important. So it's not in any way that you're saying that artists shouldn't be compensated. It's just, but I just want to say that out loud so that people understand. It's just, it's all of a sudden with streaming, there are all these things that have come up that we hadn't thought about as a possible consequence.
Exactly. We were just used to thinking that, you know, once we purchased our music correctly, wherever we went, they had the licensing issue to play that music and that music to be broadcast. Because as you said, it used to be just TV. But the whole streaming thing has opened it up. And I think we're all in the same boat, you know, skaters, artists, not just skaters, synchronized swimmers, gymnasts, dressage, all having the same thing, which is that none of us really know what to do.
Right.
And so it's going to be but I think the important thing to remember is that nobody's trying to rip anybody off. That's never, ever been the question. And skaters don't make money out of the music. You know, they don't. But I think it's going to take a while for everybody to navigate all the big companies, you know, Universal, Sony, Warners, all of those people who are involved in with the big, you know, some big artists. It's going to take a while to navigate those waters. And so in the meantime, I think everybody just has to do the best they can.
So, Carol, does this add to does this add another layer of work to your Olympic preparation? Not just yours, but any coach. Like,
oh yes,
does this take time?
It does take time.
Okay,
it does take time. Yes.
If I want to skate to, you know, giant singer X, let's say, and I come to you and I say, Carol, can you help me with you know, my singles program? It wouldn't be very good, Carol, I'm just telling you, but we'll just go with that. But does that then mean that, first of all, instead of sort of noodling with the concept in your mind, you have to go and get this other part fixed first? And do you have like plan A music, plan B music, plan C music? Like, is that what goes on?
Well, for example, let's say you bring me, you know, artist X, big cheese artist. And so the next thing I would do would be, say, go to Click and Clear and see if that artist is available. If the answer is no, there may be other artists who have covered that song.
Okay.
And you may be able to find a version that you can use.
Okay.
So that's sort of the plan B. And if there is nothing there that you know we like or is suitable, then perhaps we have to think again.
Okay. So, and that's all before anybody steps on the ice to do choreography and to figure out. And then the rules, I know that the rules for ice dance, that they often change and that they're quite late in terms of, you know, that they come into play sort of like June-ish.
Yes.
How are you already thinking, you, Caroline, are you already thinking about, 2 years ago, are you thinking about the Olympic Games coming up in Milano Cortina and thinking, gee, I'd love to be able to go towards this kind of a program, not necessarily rhythm because the rhythm dance hasn't, you know, wouldn't have been announced by them, but free dance concepts. Are you thinking in advance?
To a certain extent, yes. But the fact that the rhythm dance is not announced is a big impact because
Sure. You
don't want to do two programs that end up being the same. So until you know what that rhythm dance is for the season, and then you make sure you can steer away from that, it can limit your choices. I mean, not that you would necessarily, you know, go that way anyway, but it is a consideration. And we really are, I think, as a community, trying to push that we have the rhythms announced 2 or 3 years in advance, because that makes a difference to our planning.
Sure.
Because let's say I decided this year to do a 90s free dance with Piper and Paul. Let's just say, oh, we're going to do that. And then the rhythm dance was announced as being the 90s. I'd be like, oh, to do that.
right.
Rethink that one. So I think it's always, Olympic year is always, you know, exciting and interesting and terrifying and difficult and amazing and all of those things. But I would say definitely it's gone this year from not what programs would I like to do, but what programs would I like to do? Is that music available? Will we be able to get the composing rights? Will we be able to get the music editing rights? Will we be able to get the performing rights? And how much will all that cost?
So that's a lot.
I went from the express checkout,
yes,
to the longest line for the cashier.
You actually went to the training cashier line.
I did.
On her day one or his day one.
Yeah, that's a bit how it felt.
Mm-hmm.
And also because it's not like you ask the question and you get an answer. It's like you ask the question and maybe 3 months later you get the answer.
Which is a long time in planning time.
Yeah, it is. So it's definitely added a whole other, and there are a few, I think, you know, what they're calling no-fly zones, or, you know, artists that have just said no, completely no.
Okay.
So at least if you can find that out, you know, if you've picked one of those, well, then you know, okay, that's not going to be happening this year. But someone from, you know, another country may still go ahead and do that, depending on what advice or strategy or whatever they're getting in their particular situation.
And the consequences may not be the same. That's exactly. The other problem. So we're not dealing with an even playing field.
Yeah. So it's definitely added a whole other 7 or 8 layers to that whole process.
Was there ever in the past, was there ever a program or music that was in your mind for any level, any skater, any time, that you said, I can't wait to use, to develop a program using that music for this team? Doesn't have to be Piper and Paul, could be anybody.
I kind of feel that way about every program.
Okay.
I don't know. I think perhaps, I remember when Karis Ralph and Asher Hill did their African rhythm dance.
I was going to say that one. That was one of my favorites.
And they were so totally invested in that. And it was so different from anything that anybody else chose to take on board. And it was so, you know, Eurus and I always say every year, oh, now we have to be an expert in African dance. Now we have to be an expert in 90s. Now we have to be an expert in the Charleston. Like you know, it's very, and that's where we go back to pulling in people that actually do that. But we understand when we involve other people in that process that our job, we define the jobs clearly, which is that our job is to produce the skating part, including some or, you know, of the other part of, let's say, well, of the 90s style. But then we have an expert in the 90s style, and we're going to give her as much rein as we possibly can to do her thing. And what we try to do is have so much on each side that, again, we go back to the menu and I can take this from her and this bit that we did, and it all kind of comes together.
Wow. That is so interesting. Okay. Two last questions. One is, any advice for little dancers out there who would like to eventually get to the Olympic Games?
Just keep doing what you're doing. I remember when Paul was with his previous partner, Vanessa Krohn, and they had just one novice. And I believe they were, I want to say 13 and 14, pretty young. And I kind of looked at the landscape and blah, blah, blah. And I said, you know what? If you guys work hard, you can go to Olympics in Vancouver in 2010. And they all laughed at me, but they went.
They sure did.
Went because we fixed our eyes on the goal and we went after the goal. So listen to your coaches. And the one thing I would say to every young dancer coming up is be as much a part of all of the process as you possibly can. Ask questions, be curious. Do what your coaches tell you, but ask them things. Get as much information as you can. Watch great performances. Watch as much dance in any genre as you can. It is amazing what you can. There is so much information out there now. If I'd have had access when I was skating to what the kids have access to now, I would have thought I'd have died and gone to heaven. Mm-hmm. But it's almost like there's so much they don't do it.
Because so, they don't know to do it either. That's the other part. Yeah.
They don't know. So, and I read something marvelous the other day, which was that George Balanchine, the famous ballet choreographer, had once said that he felt the greatest dancer that had ever lived was Fred Astaire.
Okay.
Which I'm totally on board.
Yeah.
You know, and I was talking about it to actually one of my younger teams, and they didn't know who either of those people were.
Okay.
So we had a discussion about that. And you do try to educate as much as possible. You know, we show, obviously, I'm sure every coach does, shows kids, you know, great performances and things from the past. But I find, you know, I know Paul, for example, will come in occasionally and say, oh, I've had the most marvelous afternoon watching all the Russian dance teams from 1974.
Yeah, sounds like Paul, actually.
It does sound like Paul, right? But it's actually one of the reasons he's good.
Yeah.
It's because he's interested, mm-hmm. curious about things that came before. And we learn, we were talking, again, another little anecdote. We were talking about the moonwalk the other day. And, you know, whether the moonwalk had originated in the 90s and, you know, with Michael Jackson and all the, and I said, no, it didn't. And they all looked at me. I said, Charlie Chaplin did it.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
He did.
I look it up.
Yeah, he did. And I had actually seen that because I was watching some old Charlie Chaplin things the other day. And they were talking about Charlie Chaplin actually being the first person to do, or maybe recorded person. You should always say that, right? Recorded person.
Yep.
To do the moonwalk. And I watched it and I was like, that is so cool.
You know, that is fascinating. And it brings me to sort of my final question. My final question has to do with resources. And we just spoke about resources. Can you come up with three programs on your YouTube playlist that are figure skating that you could watch over and over again? I know there are tons if you're like me, but just what are three that Carol Lane could watch over and over again?
Number one would be Torvald and Dean's Encounter.
Okay.
That's my all-time favorite. They did it when they were professionals, so it's not a competitive program, if you like, but it's definitely my number one. Then I would pick Pakhomova and Gorshkov doing the Tango Romantica.
Oh, yeah, which they invented.
Which they invented, yes. Yep. Just because I still think that construction-wise, musicality, invention, it's probably, for me, maybe the best pattern dance ever invented. And then number three would be, gosh, it's actually really hard. Like those,
there's lots of them.
I know, there's lots of them. Wow.
My defaults always do Shaney's.
Yes.
Because they were so unusual for their time. Isabelle and Paul.
I love their tango. Their rhythm, yeah, me too. Rhythm dance. It was an OSP then. But it was fabulous. I mean, basically, I could pick anything Torvald and Dean did and have a whole list.
You know what? Exactly. So for those of you that want to know about ice dance, get out there. Get to your YouTube.
I'm going to pick Tessa and Scott's rhythm dance as it was when they won junior and they did Tears on My Pillow.
Oh.
And I remember watching that and thinking how just gorgeous it was. Perfect age, perfect music, perfect choreography. And it was just stunning, stunning. And I'm going to pick that. I know they did, 100 amazing programs. And again, I could pick loads of things of theirs. But I remember when I think about Tessa and Scott, that's my go-to program. Still, I'll go back and watch that. I love it.
You know what, Carol Lane? Thank you so much for talking to me. You have been the perfect guest. Speaking of perfection, all the best this season. I'm sure we'll be seeing each other once in a while. That's for sure.
Absolutely. And just
thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks, PJ. Thanks, everybody.
Bye for now.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Let's Talk About It, the Skate Ontario podcast. Don't forget to follow us on social media. I'm at Skating PJ. Until next time, bye for now.